Susan Avon Medding. Welcome to Disordered, a podcast about food, our relationship with our bodies, and learning to live and love yourself again. Eating disorders are still a taboo subject in 2021, and despite how much we speak about mental health, eating disorders are often still seen as something secretive and shameful. I am not an expert in eating disorders, but I am someone who has lived with one for almost two decades. I'm not here to give medical advice, but simply to try and unpick some of the complexity of disordered eating through a series of conversations I will have with people who are speaking from firsthand experience. Disordered eating will impact each and every one of us at some point in our lives. I want to delve deeper. At what point does disordered eating become an eating disorder? Through looking closer at the spectrum of these mental illnesses, I hope that you will be challenged in your own view of what an eating disorder looks like. This week, I'll be speaking with Harriet Parsons. She is a psychotherapist and the training and development manager with Bodywise, the national charity for eating disorders in Ireland. Their mission is to ensure support, awareness, and understanding of eating disorders amongst the wider community, as well as advocating for the rights and healthcare needs of people affected by eating disorders. Well, thank you so much for being here today, Harriet. This conversation is going to be, as I said, a bit different to all the other ones that we've been having over the last couple of weeks, because up until now, I've only kind of been speaking to people who have like firsthand, you know, gone through eating disorders or disordered eating. But you, I suppose, are coming at it from the other side, yes. Having worked in this field for nearly two decades, right?
God. Yes, a long time,
Yeah. Well, before we get into that, I was doing a bit of research on you and I found something very interesting. That you originally trained as a ballerina.
I did, yes, I did. When I was 16, I auditioned for a ballet school in Russia.
Wow.
And myself and my friends, we all went off to ballet school in Siberia.
What made you want to get into psychotherapy and more particularly like the area of eating disorders?
Well, I suppose it's a lot of eating disorders in ballet.
Yes.
So it had always kind of been an area of interest, and the Russians also had a very kind of strange attitude towards things as well. So it just was very interesting. So then I decided I would do psychology and psychoanalysis. You could study psychoanalysis as an undergraduate in what's now DBS, what was LSB at the time. My stepfather was a psychoanalyst, so I grew up in the world of kind of psychoanalysis as well. So, and I kind of knew a lot of the lecturers who were teaching there, and that, so it felt kind of familiar. And it felt like a place I could try and figure out what I wanted to do with my life. So I did that. So I did an undergraduate BA, and then I worked in the Rape Crisis Centre for a year. And then after that year, I decided I'd go and do an MA in addiction studies. So I did that. And then I had my daughter. And then when she was kind of about 6 months old, my mum said, come on, you've got to do something with your life. So it was lucky that it kind of coincided with the intake for the psychotherapy MA, MSc in St. Vincent's, which is attached to UCD. So, and that's psychoanalytic MSc in psychotherapy. So I did that and then trained as a psychotherapist, psychoanalytic psychotherapist. And then when I was in my final year there, a part-time job came up in Bodywise.
Okay.
Managing the helpline.
In January 2018, the HSE launched the National Model of Care for Eating Disorders in conjunction with Bodywise and the College of Psychiatrists of Ireland. This model of care is intended to be a blueprint for how services for patients with eating disorders will be developed and continuously improved nationally. The aim is to improve quality and safety, access to services for all ages, and provide value for money in how these services are delivered. Did you know that's kind of where you wanted to go immediately?
So I had, well, I'm not Bodywise, but I had done my thesis, my BA thesis on eating disorders, my addiction studies thesis on eating disorders.
So that's where, and that's, you knew that was the field you
were
going into.
That was the area. Yeah. And you see, when you're studying in St. Vincent's, you, as part of your study, you attend the clinical case conferences once a week. And because they're the only adult centre, adult facility for eating disorders within the public service, it would often be a patient from the eating disorder ward that was presented. So it was really interesting.
Yeah.
So when the part-time job came up in Bodywise, because I had already worked in the as a telephone counsellor in the Rape Crisis Centre, so it made sense. I knew what I was doing. So so I got that part-time job, and basically I've never left. So out of that part-time job with Bodywise, I then started to take on other services, and then there was some moving around of personnel, and basically my job grew out of that. So for a good few years, I was the services manager, looking after all of the support services. And then what happened in about 2015 onwards, the HSE started to plan the model of care, you know, the new National Clinical Programme for Eating Disorders. And we were part of that working group. Now, not me personally at that point, it was our CEO. And then it became clear as we neared 2018, where the model of care was launched, that actually Bodywise would need somebody within the organisation whose job it was to provide the support element to the clinical programme and work with the working group and continue to do that work. And then around the same time, I developed the PILLAR programme, which is the family support programme. And so all those things kind of fell in place, and it became too much to do everything. So I'm shifted to this role that I'm in now, which is called Training and Development Manager. And then Cathy Downs took on the services manager.
In our conversation, Harriet articulated really well the difference between eating disorders and disordered eating. This is really interesting, looking back at the conversations we've had to date.
What is the definition of an eating disorder, and what is the difference between disordered eating and a diagnosed eating disorder?
So an eating disorder, I mean, diagnostically, an eating disorder is a psychiatric illness. It's characterized by a severe disturbance in eating, leading to physical consequences and accompanied by distorted thinking and distress, emotional distress. Yeah, so an eating disorder, actually, it's very difficult to sum up what it is in one sentence because it's not just one thing.
Yeah.
And it straddles, and in that way, it's really complicated because it does straddle different areas of medicine as well. So you can't say it's just this or it's just that. It is everything, and it's all influenced together. You know, it's all mixed up together. So an eating disorder is not just about food and weight, although it is about that.
Yeah.
It's not just about distorted thinking and how the person feels about themselves, although it is really about that.
Yeah.
And it's not just about them being physically unwell. But obviously, when someone is physically unwell, you can't ignore that. So it is about all of those aspects. It's a very good question as to how does kind of normal disordered eating differ from an eating disorder? Because it is really complicated, and it is very difficult to know where that line is. The way I think about it is that if you think of normal disordered eating on a spectrum, and you, at one end you have normal disordered eating, and at the other end you have eating disorder. Normal disordered eating we can all relate to because we all engage in it. Nobody eats exactly the same all the time. How we feel affects how we feed ourselves. So what, we're in December now. I was thinking last night, oh God, I'm getting into Christmas mode. So, you know, after my dinner when I'm sitting down, I had a hot port and cheese and crackers and chocolate and stuff, which maybe I didn't have in November, you know, and I was feeling cold, and you know, so I ate a particular way because I was feeling a certain way.
Yep.
And that's really, really normal. How we feel affects how we feed ourselves. But where then does that kind of disordered eating cross into something that's diagnosable, that's affecting a person's life, stopping them from being able to live, like into eating disorder territory? To my mind, it's where the behavior is compulsive. So it's where compulsion comes in.
Yeah.
And that means that it's where the person no longer feels that they are choosing to do the disordered behavior. Like, I'm choosing to have, you know, snacks, whatever. It's, I feel I cannot have cheese and crackers. If I dare have it, I will have a panic attack and my whole day will be ruined and the rest of the week I might as well, you know, write off because I'll be feeling so bad about myself. It's where I cannot possibly have that dinner and not go to the bathroom afterwards.
Yeah.
And not purge. It's where no matter what temperature it is outside, I have to go for my run or else I will just feel like the worst person in the world. And I have this negative self-talk. So it's where whatever the disordered behavior is, that's compulsive. And when something is compulsive, it means that we don't actually feel we have a choice about doing it. It's like there's something making us do it, or it's like there's something in us that is trying to satisfy itself through us. So there's no conscious thought in it. And to my mind, that's where we cross from normal disordered eating into eating disorder. So often people like media journalists, they often ask about clean eating and this idea, yes, of orthorexia.
Yeah.
And with orthorexia, you know, it's the idea of this clean eating type of eating where people won't eat processed food, where they will have rules about what they can and they can't eat and all this kind of stuff. And, you know, that's promoted as being healthy and being, they're being very conscientious and they're being, you know, careful about the world and the environment and all that kind of stuff. But I always say, okay, that's fine. But if they were stuck in an airport for 36 hours and all there was a vending machine that had crisps and chocolate, would they starve themselves rather than having something to eat?
Sure.
Yeah. And yeah, that's the bit, I think.
Yeah.
So if the behavior is compulsive, there is no way they would let themselves go to the vending machine. If it's normal,
they'd be like, oh, it doesn't matter. Yeah.
For God's sake,
yeah,
I'm not going to starve.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, I have to eat something. So yeah, I'm going to have this bar of chocolate, you know.
It can be so damaging to an individual when an eating disorder is not caught early. Again and again, people are told they are not sick enough or do not meet the diagnostic criteria. It is important that going forward in the treatment of these mental illnesses, that health professionals look at the full picture. Remember, weight is just one determining factor when looking at a person's health. Early intervention has been proven to be the fastest way to recover.
You can have a normal BMI and still have very severe anorexia, and that the extent to which your mind is distorted and the extent to which you are unwell is not actually dependent on what weight you are. And often, you know, I mean, I had a call from a mum the other week who had a 15-year-old who, she said, had lost a lot of weight in a short period of time. And as often parents can sometimes say, well, she was a bit, you know, overweight or whatever. And, you know, so she doesn't want to put on all the weight again and that kind of thing. And her BMI was pretty normal. So the GP had said, well, it's not the type of BMI that I would refer on for. Mm. But actually what was alarming about it was the amount of weight she lost within a short period of time. Yeah. So that's the alarming bit. So there's loads of different parts to that puzzle to get it so that everybody's on the same page around, you know, what are our red flags, what are our warning signs, and where do people go? And you hear it again and again, people feeling like a fraud, feeling like because they weren't hospitalized that they're not a genuine, you know, person with anorexia or with bulimia, that they never got sick enough to really warrant recovering properly. They feel, well, if only I had ended up in hospital, then I'd know that I was really sick and I would, you know, get better. I would allow myself to get better.
Yeah.
And that's a huge barrier in people's heads to kind of making that decision to try and get better. And it's very, very difficult to try and help somebody to motivate them to keep going,
yeah,
if they feel that way. I always think it's really good to just keep emphasizing how you don't compare yourself to somebody else.
Mm.
You know, your eating disorder is different. Your journey, to be kind of cliche about it, is different. And you cannot measure someone's illness based on how they physically were.
Early research seems to point to the fact that there are certain risk factors that can predispose a person to developing an eating disorder, such as genetics. Personalities that lean towards perfectionism, control, and all-or-nothing thinking can also play a role. Circumstances such as trauma or change in a person's life can increase their risk level too.
Are people predisposed to having eating disorders? Is it something, I know there are a lot of
like risk factors when it comes to this. But are some people kind of destined to get one, or is it something that can affect literally anyone?
I think it can affect literally anyone, but I think that there are risk factors that are internal to the person that make a person more vulnerable to, say, developing something like an eating disorder. I suppose the first one is the genetics part of it. There is lots of work going into researching the genetics of eating disorders and the genetics of anorexia. And they have found some genetic or genome type. They don't understand it fully, so they don't necessarily know, you know, if you can have it and not develop an eating disorder, or, you know, what switches it on or whatever, what combination. But I think the latest kind of breakthrough with that, which happened a few months ago, was they did a genome comparison, and they found that, yes, there were lots of kind of markers that, say, would be similar to people, you know, who, to bipolar or to, you know, severe kind of other psychiatric disorders, but that there were also markers that were similar to people who have metabolic disorders. What that seems to indicate, if I'm understanding it correctly, is that they have a sense that when someone's weight dips to a certain point, that actually it kicks in those metabolic factors, and that person can tolerate hunger in a way that's different from somebody who doesn't have those markers.
Wow.
Yeah. So at that level, there's something else going on that allows somebody, because, you know, you hear people saying, I just couldn't not eat, like I'd just be too. And then you hear somebody saying, oh, I'm fine. But there is something that they're finding at kind of a genetic level that maybe answers the question as to what's going on there. Other things that make a person vulnerable are a tendency towards perfectionism.
Yep, I have that.
High achieving. all or nothing thinking.
Yep.
Black and white thinking. Yep. Difficulty, you know, tolerating change or, you know, difficult behavior, those kind of things. So they're kind of personality things that are often with the person. But also, I suppose I would think about those things from a psychoanalytic perspective as well. And, you know, those things are also shaped by, you know, your place in the family and how you relate and how people relate to you and all of that. So, yes, they are personal factors or internal factors, but they also are not coming out of nowhere. Not that you can necessarily change them, but I suppose retrospectively, it's the idea that you could maybe understand them and be aware of them and notice, especially with all or nothing thinking. I think a big part of getting over an eating disorder is recognizing all or nothing thinking and being able to kind of calm yourself and see the gray area and tolerate, you know, imperfection, tolerate, you know, I think Coleman Octor says not being 9 or 10 or 1 or 2, tolerate being, you know, 6, 5, 6, middle ground is really important. So, yeah. So I don't think people are destined to have an eating disorder, but I think that there definitely are things that, because those personality traits are, you know, when you think about an eating disorder, they absolutely fit perfectly with an eating disorder. All or nothing thinking, you know, I have a set of rules that I have to follow.
Yeah, the control.
The control aspect. You know, perfectionism, being perfect at it, overachieving, you know, not being able to be kind to yourself, you know, not being able to let yourself off the hook.
Yeah.
You know, feeling like you're being watched, feeling like you're in competition. All of those aspects of an eating disorder are like the perfect fit for somebody with that personality type. And it's also, I mean, it's not always necessarily that there's a traumatic, you know, an objectively traumatic thing happening, that it's often a subjective trauma.
Sure.
So it's something that that for some reason that particular person finds really difficult.
Yeah.
And that could be like, we say this very good little story around a girl called Kate who develops anorexia. And for her, it's like a boyfriend breaks up with her.
Mm-hmm.
And it's her first proper boyfriend. And for her, this is the first time somebody hasn't liked her.
Yep.
And she's always got on well with everybody. And this is the first time somebody hasn't liked her. And not only does he not like her, but she really likes him. And not just that, but there's nothing that's happened that she can blame. So the only place she can look for a reason is in herself.
Yeah.
And often when you start looking at somebody's story, you find that there's something that's very ordinary. Mm. But for that person in their life at that particular moment, when that happened, what was required was a strong sense of self, like transition year, for example. So from junior cert exam year into a less stressful no exam year. It's supposed to be the best year, you know, heaven. For some kids, it's, we hear it all the time, eating disorders developing in transition year.
That was me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. 16. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's that, you know, that, you know, for most people, that's fine. But for some people, you know, that's the year where it's all about your sense of who you are. Mm. And all about you figuring out, well, what do I like and what interests me? And for somebody who up until that point has done really well, has, you know, flown their exams, has worked really hard, they have all these external markers saying to them, you're great. And now there are no markers and it's just about feeling okay. And at that moment in time, I always think it's like a little crack, you know, a little fault line in a sense of self appears. And what can happen is that the eating disorder just kind of comes in and fills up that fault line. It makes the person feel strong again. Mm-hmm. And they feel like, oh, I've got this now. I feel like I know who I am. You know, I know how I'm going to live. This makes me feel better. This makes me feel strong. And the really awful thing is that for a time it works.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
For many people, their eating disorder affects a large portion of their life. As a result, a person's identity may be tied up in the illness. Letting go and starting on that path to recovery can be extremely challenging and fearful, as it may feel as though you are losing a part of yourself. Who you actually are as a person is far beyond your eating disorder.
And I always describe it like it seeps out and takes over the entire sense of self until the person kind of doesn't know who they would be without it.
Yeah.
And that's exactly that. You know?
Yeah, that's really hard because even now, you know, I suppose I'm at a place where I'm in a good place in my life. But even now, I don't know who I would be without it. Like, it's still very much a part of my life, you know, and it is a sad thing that, you know, people kind of lose so much of themselves and just wouldn't recognize themselves without it.
Yeah.
It's very, it's like, it's really insidious, isn't it?
It's just so insidious. Yeah. It really is. And especially when you have somebody, say, who's an adult who's had an eating disorder for, you know, maybe for all of their teenage years or for a good part of their 20s or something, then, you know, they've never gone through those kind of normal bumps in the road of teenager and early adult life without the eating disorder. Mm-hmm. So they don't know how to do it. They don't know how they should, and I'm using quotation marks, how they should feel about those things.
Yeah.
So letting go of the eating disorder and trying to allow themselves to feel and to cope without it is so challenging, because they look like they should know, but actually they don't know because they've never done it.
Yeah, they've always had that kind of fall back on, or that kind of lens to look through.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Bodywise was set up in the 90s, initially as a support group, and was born of a need for support and assistance for individuals and their loved ones going through an eating disorder. They offer many services, including the newly launched Pilar group that educates those who are helping loved ones through the process.
Tell me a little bit about the services that Bodywise provides, because I know it's the National Eating Disorders Association of Ireland, and you guys are the only one, really, aren't you?
Yeah, so we're the national charity, you know, voluntary organization. Yeah, so we were founded in 1995 by a group of parents who all had a child diagnosed with an eating disorder, like not necessarily a child under 18, I think a couple of adults. And there was nothing, there was no support. So in the way this happens in Ireland, so, you know, something happens, people band together, they put something in place.
That's usually the way that things develop, isn't it?
It really is. It really is. And out of that support group that they formed, the organization grew. And up until COVID, that group was still running. So the ethos has always been, you know, supporting people affected by eating disorders in Ireland. So that's people themselves who have an eating disorder, but also family and friends, recognising that oftentimes they are, you know, the supporters are the most important bit, you know, even when the person isn't able to even think about getting better, the supporters are still supporting, the family are still there. And then as a person gets well, no matter what age that person is, there are always people around them who, if they have knowledge, if they have support, are better placed to be able to support them. So that's always been the kind of role that we've had for ourselves. And our support ethos across any services or anything that we do is that, you know, we really see an eating disorder very simply as a coping mechanism, a destructive coping mechanism, but a coping mechanism. So we don't kind of promote any particular form of treatment or any particular kind of theory around the what an eating disorder is. We just keep it simple and we're objective. We understand that everyone's experience is different, and that what it's really important when you're supporting someone that you never assume you know what they're going through, mm-hmm. you know. And so our ethos is always that we do not focus on what the person is doing. We focus on how they're feeling about what they're doing. Mm-hmm. So that's the ethos that kind of goes across all of our services. So the services are, well, I suppose we have a telephone helpline.
Okay.
We have an email support service, which is like a helpline in an email. So people email in, hopefully the next day, although it's so busy at the moment, it might be 2 days later. Sometimes it could be 3 days later. But that's not a bad thing. You know, it's containment. And they get a very thoughtful. All of our email responses are like a helpline call, but they are written fresh. You know, mm-hmm. So we have a team of people writing emails every day. And those people, they're the hardest service to work on as well. You know, it's incredibly difficult to write those emails, because you have to read it. You have to think about, well, what is this person actually asking? Not just what they've written, what's the feel of it? And then you have to be so careful about how you reply. Mm. We have to be non-directive, yet give enough information that they know what to do.
Yeah.
We have to present that information in a way that the person doesn't feel like we're telling them what to do. We have to help the person to think through how they might read what we say. So reflective bit. We have to be safe and we have to be secure for them. And we have to be different than what they might get anywhere else. Mm. So we're not concerned with what they've eaten that day. We're not concerned with what their weight is. We might just be concerned with how they feel about the fact that they said something that sounds really all or nothing.
Yeah.
So we might reflect to somebody and say, when you say that, that sounds a bit all or nothing. I wonder, can you hear that?
Mm.
You know, to our mind, when we see that, it sounds like what people say about the eating disorder voice.
Mm.
Can you hear that in what you've said?
Yeah.
So often then the responses that we get back after our emails are like, this is the first time anyone has ever listened to me.
Yeah, or that you've actually heard what I'm saying. Yeah,
this is, I feel so relieved after getting your reply. That has been the most informative email I've ever had in my life. Yeah. You know, we get really good responses back. And people then use the service regularly. So people email on a regular basis. I think it's
amazing to have the email, because a lot of people would be terrified to actually speak to someone.
Absolutely.
Like even in general, like a lot of times people find it easier to put words down on an email than to actually pick up the phone and talk to a live
absolutely.
Human being. So that's amazing that you offer that.
And 85% of emailers are the person themselves who has an eating disorder, whereas on the helpline it's like 50-50 parents and people themselves.
Yeah.
So we have the helpline, we have the email service, we have online support groups. So online support groups for people with an eating disorder. We do not have a family and friends online support group. We have two groups. So we have one for under 18s and one for adults. And they happen once a week in the evening. The teen one is on a Sunday evening from 7:30 until 9. And the adult one is either on a Monday or a Wednesday evening from 7:30 until 9. And those groups are chat-based, so there's no video. They seem very basic now that everyone's Zooming and doing all of that, but their chat, you know, actually it's good. There's no visuals. You can't see anybody, which is good, I think. They have two facilitators present to keep the group space safe for everybody, you know, because again, the ground rules are We don't talk about food. We don't talk about weight. We ask people not to go into the specifics of what they're doing.
Sure.
So it's fine to say I binged or I purged, but not to say
what,
how long or where. Yeah, all of that stuff. And because we have to keep it non-competitive and safe for everybody. And actually, it's amazing, like in that group, you can have somebody who might have anorexia and somebody who might have binge eating disorder, and they can totally relate to each other.
Absolutely, because the psychology of it is...
Exactly, yeah. So we have that. We used to have a face-to-face support group in the city centre, but since COVID, we haven't been able to run that.
And that was, you had one for both, didn't you?
Yeah, when it
was,
we had family and friends and for people with eating disorders, and they're always, the family and friends not so well attended, but the people with eating disorders group always quite well attended. And actually it's funny, there's in the last year of the stats, I think so now we're 2019, at every group there was a boy or a man. And we even had one group that was all men, which I find really, like, the stats for men attending the face-to-face group are always higher than stats on the helpline or in the online support group, which is phenomenal, because they actually have to get up, get the bus into town, go to the group, sit there, and then go home and come back again. And to have one man at every group and then have only men at one of the groups, you know, because people don't sign up, they just show up on the night.
Yep.
We've no idea who's going to be there or not going to be there. So it's really good. And we have a few male facilitators as well, which I think
is
good as well. So we have that group, and we also have, well, we have now, we have the Pillar program, which is based, so it's Pillar, so peer-led resilience. It's based on the idea, it's for family and friends, and it's based on the idea of bringing those people together and working with them for one evening a week for 4 weeks in a structured kind of way. It came out of the idea that really attendance was low at our family and friends support group. What the facilitators, you know, in supervision, what they would be saying was, you know, they just want answers to questions. They are very, you know, they're not really in a space where they can have that support group. You know, we're not interested in your person, we're interested in you. That was almost too difficult for them. So they needed something different. And we can't have volunteers, you know, because it takes years of experience to be able to handle parent queries, really, you know, in the way that was coming up. So so what we did was we put together this 4 week program where basically, you know, each week I kind of bring them through. So we start off with the understanding eating disorders kind of talk, you know, going through. So I start off from the idea that nobody knows anything. Now, I know that people are coming with years of experience, and it's great for the people who don't know anything and who don't understand. It can be difficult for the people who feel like they've been supporting their, like, child who's in their 40s for 20 years.
Yeah.
But actually what those parents have said to me at the end of the 4 weeks is that they had lost complete patience and now they feel renewed. Mm. That they have understood eating disorders in a way they had never thought about them before. So we do offer something kind of different. And what I do is we build this kind of, like, very from that simple idea of an eating disorder as a coping mechanism. We use that block, and from that we build on that as to, you know, if we take that, how then can we think of anorexia and bulimia and binge eating disorder? How then can we think of how a person gets caught up in an eating disorder? And then week two and week three, we think about drilling down kind of into them, into how a person with an eating disorder interprets their world, so that if we understand how a person interprets their world, then we can start to reinterpret the way we experience that person's behaviors, mm-hmm. because we have understanding. So when a person, say, hits out and uses bad language and behaves like they're possessed or something, we can reframe that and think their eating disorder is making them hit out and trying to push us away so that it's not challenged at all. Yeah. So they're behaving that way because they do not want us in any way to come near them, to support them, to help them, because the eating disorder is feeling threatened.
Yeah.
So by reframing it, they're able to start to reinterpret how their, you know, their person's behavior in the home, and then how they support that person. And you hear the change happening, you know, and there's been you can hear it through the 4 weeks. So we also cover things like communication, having conversations, managing meal times, triggers, managing triggers. And then the last week is always about recovery and treatment a little bit, and recovery. So one of the thesis that I did was on the recovery process, where I interviewed people and I got them to talk about how they recovered from an eating disorder. And then I kind of drew out kind of similar themes. And so that's what I feed back to people on Pillar. You know, it's not about recovery is this. It's the experiential, you know, idea about recovery, how people experience recovery, what it's like for a person to recover. What are the things that actually change in recovery? You know, things like self-awareness, things like learning not to use food to cope, learning to trust yourself bit by bit, you know, that kind of, all these kind of ideas, so that they don't just judge recovery by weight and by eating. Yeah, so, I mean, so it's very successful. People give great feedback, and even more so, I love when the person with the eating disorder manages some way to come back and say, I've had a couple of people come back and say, my husband did Pillar, or my parents did Pillar. Mm-hmm. When this girl came back and she said, oh, my parents did the Pillar program, it was the best thing that helped. She said it taught them how to understand my eating disorder with compassion, mm-hmm. which in turn I was able to apply to myself.
Yeah.
And that's lovely to hear. That's, you know,
It's
great to support the parents. They obviously need it. But it's amazing when you hear people saying, somebody else said, you know, my mum never comes home angry. She always comes home calm, you know, when we were doing it face to face. So I suppose, I mean, ultimately, it's about supporting the people who are supporting.
Yeah.
But if it helps the person who has the eating disorder as well, that's amazing.
Yeah, it has like a knock-on effect, a ripple effect. So that's all online now. Is it only suitable for people who are supporting someone who's like at the beginning of their journey, or like in a really active illness? Or, as you say, can it be for people who are like 20 years down the line?
It's for everybody. It's for anybody. And you just sign up for it by emailing pillar@bodywise.ie.
Okay.
And then you just say, can you put me on the list for Pillar? And then we will let you know when it's running. So you don't have to be checking the website all the time and that.
That's such an amazing resource. And obviously all of the services you provide are free, because
they're
you're
free.
A voluntary organization.
Yeah,
that's
exactly.
Amazing. Putting pressure on the politicians who make decisions about budget is vital when it comes to securing funding for our mental health services. If you want to use your voice to call for change, contact your local TDs or our Minister for Mental Health, Minister Mary Butler.
Tell me just a little bit about what are the actual services that are available like on the public system at the moment?
So at the moment, what are we? December 2020. At the moment, so if you're going publicly, your GP is the gateway into the service. So basically, the referral pathway is the same everywhere. And that is, the GP is the gateway into the public mental health services. So the GP has to make the referral into either the CAMHS, so the Child and Adolescent Mental Health Service, or the AMHS, the Adult Mental Health Service. When the model of care was launched in 2018 for the National Clinical Programme for Eating Disorders, the idea it was that it would have a 5-year implementation plan. And at the end of the 5 years, that there would be kind of 16 adult specialised teams and 16 child specialised teams. And it was based on a kind of hub and spoke model, so that there would be specialist experience teams by population size. Mm-hmm. So it goes by population size, because to be expert and experienced, you have to have a certain number of cases per year. Mm. So there's no point in putting a specialised team in a place where there's less population.
Yeah.
Even though we might think, so for example, Galway, I think, or no, Limerick isn't, say, a hub. It's a spoke to Galway because it's a bigger population. Whereas you might in your head think it should have its own. You
sure,
know what I mean?
Yeah.
So that's just an example. And the idea is that no matter where you are in the country, that even if you're in a very small place, like population size, if you go to your GP and your GP then will refer into the normal CAM service, but that CAM service will have access to the specialists from the hub.
Okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So, and there will be somebody within that CAMHS team who is trained specifically in providing an evidence-based treatment approach for eating disorders. Okay.
Okay.
So that's the idea, and that's the goal, and that still is the goal. And, you know, if funding keeps coming, it will get there. Where we're at the moment is that, just to say, the other part of that plan is that the idea of having the specialist hubs teams is that the GP can make the referral directly into the specialist team for an eating disorder, bypassing the regular CAMs. So okay. That means that it's quick.
Much quicker, yeah.
And it's direct.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it also frees up the regular CAMs to be dealing with the other stuff that's going on. So that's the idea. So where we are at the moment is that just before COVID hit, because some people were redeployed from the teams, but hopefully they'll be coming back. But in Dublin, we have the adult community. The adult specialist team is the Vincent's team, and that was put in place. Now, it wasn't fully resourced, as in they didn't have all the clinicians, but it was pretty much there. And then the Lindara CAMS team in Cherry Orchard Hospital, that specialist team was in place. Okay. And then the Cork CAMS team was in place, specialist team was in place. So there were these are the three main ones that are in place. And the funding kind of ground to a halt. So we're hoping now with the budget.
So there's in the plan, the 5-year plan, there should be 34.
Yeah, there should be 16 adult and 16 child. Okay. So alongside that, you have to remember that for the last, since kind of 2015, 2014, there has been a whole training program, training clinicians from all over the country in evidence-based treatment approaches for CAMS teams and for adult teams. So while there are only, say, so far these kind of three main ones, that doesn't mean that all over the country there aren't clinicians who have done that whole training program.
Yeah.
And there are.
Okay.
Yeah. So we're back into a situation where if you're lucky, you get referred.
Yeah.
The team that's in your catchment area has a couple of people in it who've done the training.
Sure.
Yeah. And that's what the clinical program is trying to stop. That it's not...
It's just the luck of the draw.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That it is, that there is a clear pathway. And it is defined and it is resourced and it's in place. And then our organisation is the support partner to that. So, for example, the Pillar Programme is a really good example of us working together. So it means that when families, say, for CAMS are referred or even for the adult services are referred, they will immediately tell them to sign up for Pillar.
Mm-hmm.
And the experience from the clinician side then is that the families who have done Pillar and are starting with them are far further along in their knowledge and their understanding and what's going to be expected of them makes their job a lot easier than, you know, getting everybody on side and in place and doing the right stuff. I've been to all the trainings, so I understand.
So you know what they're going to go through when they go to them.
So when I get all the parents' questions then on Pillar, I'm actually able to answer them knowing that I'm on the same page as all of the clinicians.
Yeah.
And also knowing how different clinicians approach things slightly differently, you know, so that I will never say this is the way it is, but I'll say, well, it could be like this or it could be like this or try this or whatever.
Yeah. So is it a matter of just money for all of these, services to be put in place? Like, is there anything that people can do to help? Is it a matter of making sure that it's in the budget or, you know, because I know a lot of people.
Yeah, it's money. So you need to lobby. You have to lobby the people who have the power, the people who set the budget and the people who decide where the money goes in the health budget.
So it's something that people can, speak to their local TDs and...
Absolutely. Yeah,
send
that's
emails,
what to do.
Harass them.
Yeah.
Just like everything else we have to harass them for.
And you can read all about it on the HSE website. There's a whole section dedicated to the clinical programme for eating disorders.
Okay.
So you can see there where it's got to. You can see what the plan is. So you can... You
can kind
it's
of
really clear.
Educate yourself on it.
And I think... you know, there's always been this narrative that there's nothing for people. There's never anything. You know, they go and look for help, like we heard last night in the news, and they're told their BMI isn't low enough to warrant treatment, inpatient treatment. And while I absolutely like agree that that is the situation and it shouldn't be that. There is also, I think, a more powerful narrative which shows that when investment is made, how it actually works. Mm. So, for example, there's been a couple of people who've been willing to talk to media, say, who have been through the Lindara CAMHS experience. Yeah.
Yep.
So say they have, like, I think maybe an 11 or a 12 year old boy, very ill. They went to the GP. GP referred directly into Lindara. Lindara saw them really quickly, like within weeks, within days maybe. He was treated, and now he's back in his life.
Yeah.
You know, a year later, he's back in his life. They're discharged from services. He's getting better all the time, and it all worked really well because the service was there.
Yeah, and he might have a chance at a normal adulthood.
Oh, he's totally fine. I was talking to the mum the other day, and he's you know, totally fine. And there's a couple of other of those kind of stories coming through now because it's, you know, it was 2018, so we're 2 years on, so we'll start to hear about them now.
Yeah.
And I think it's a really powerful narrative to be able not just to say what isn't there, but to show how much money do you save by getting somebody quickly into a service and quickly out of a service because they're treated in a timely manner, they're treated with an evidence-based treatment that works, the clinicians know what they're doing, it all works. When it all works really, really well.
Yeah.
And how much time and money is saved that way from like a budgetary standpoint, but the difference it makes to the person's life.
There are many different ideologies when it comes to recovery from an eating disorder. I have definitely been challenged in my own concept of what recovery looks like. Through the process of creating this podcast, I have learned so much from the people who have shared their experience with me. A few months ago, I was very much of the opinion that I would never be fully recovered from my eating disorder. Now, I'm at a point where I'm questioning that, and I will continue exploring the possibility of full recovery.
Yeah, I want to know what you thought about like the idea of recovery. Because when I say to someone that I am recovered, I feel not quite right in saying that because I don't believe I am recovered. I believe that I am an addict who is not currently engaging in their addiction. So I'm an alcoholic who has not had a drink in X amount of days. But for me, it's kind of like a thing that I have to work at every single day. And it's difficult and it's a journey. And I know that for me, next week, I feel like I could slip right back into it if there was, you know, something traumatic in my life or if something happened. But I know not everyone feels that way about it. I know some people feel like, no, I'm completely recovered and that's it. Mm-hmm. I'm never going back there again. That's it. I don't think that way anymore. I don't have those thoughts. Mm-hmm. What is your experience with people coming to you?
Well, I suppose I would think about it slightly differently. I totally understand what you're saying. Mm. And in many ways, I agree with it. And I think that if we're going to be realistic, we have to, you know, we think, yeah, that's totally real. And I totally get it. And that's great. Where my thinking has come to on it is, yes, an eating disorder is really like an addiction. It has loads of elements that are really similar. So it progresses, it gets worse, there's preoccupation, there's negative consequences. But the really tricky part is in terms of recovery, because I think that with addiction, as you've said, it's the idea of always recovering. And to my mind, with eating disorders, you can be recovered. Mm. And so that's why I suppose I don't necessarily buy into kind of the AA model for eating disorders, because I feel that, yes, you can get to the point where you're fine and where you are, you know, working at your recovery and all of that. But I do feel that there's another bit. And I do feel that it is possible to get to the point where you don't feel that at every, you know, that you could slip next week.
Yeah.
You know,
so maybe I'm just not there yet.
Well, I mean, but I suppose what I would say to you is that I absolutely do see it as a part of being recovered. Mm. And I think that addiction can be really helpful to try to understand what an eating disorder is. But I really see the recovery, you know, the idea of, you know, once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic, is, I see that as really tricky for eating disorders. The whole abstinence aspect of addiction treatment, I feel, is kind of counterproductive for
eating disorder. Well, also, you can't abstain from food.
You can't abstain from food. And the ideology of abstinence is kind of buys into eating disorder thinking
in the first place as well. Yeah.
So I suppose I always say, you know, that they're very similar, but they differ in terms of recovery, because it is absolutely possible to recover from an eating disorder fully. Okay. Now, like usually when I say it, somebody says, well, actually, I feel I have an eating disorder and I feel it's something I'm going to have to battle my whole life, you know, that at any point, whatever. And I absolutely respect that. And I think that that's fine. But I do think that people can get to a point where they don't feel that they're going to respond to whatever happens in their world through their disordered eating behavior.
Yeah.
You know, where they can trust themselves to be able to cope without it and to be okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think, and a woman that we sometimes do a bit of work with, Keelty Oberlin, who just did a recovery PhD for Trinity on recovery from eating disorders. She talks about there being this thing like a pseudo recovery, which is kind of that idea of feeling recovered, but also feeling like I could not be, you know, but still, in, you know, still not quite there.
Yeah.
And I think, and what she was saying as well, is that there is another bit.
Okay. You know.
But the thing is that you have to think then about, well, what does that mean? And how can that be a helpful idea?
Mm.
Yeah. And I think what's really unhelpful is the idea that you don't start to live properly until you're fully recovered, okay?
Yeah.
Because I don't think that that happens. Yeah. I think that people have to live to recover. And that's what I would say to the parents all the time, because they often have in their head the idea that their person is sick and that they have to get them better and then life will start again. And actually, that's not the way. Life has to start in order for them to get better.
Yeah.
So it's not that, you know, feeling that, you know, next week you could whatever, means that you're not living a recovered life, so to speak. What it means is that you have to keep on living to figure out those bits, like to figure out what's going
what
on
is,
there.
What is holding you back, or what is it that...
Or just what is that other bit? Like what you know, and it takes a lot of work. It takes... you know, years and years of therapy to try and really figure out that stuff, especially if you've had an eating disorder for a very long time.
Yeah.
You know, it takes years to be able to work out that stuff, to be able to know yourself well enough to know the patterns that you fall in, to know your thought patterns. And even when you know them, you still fall into them.
Yeah.
You know, and even when you know yourself really well, you still find yourself suddenly in a situation where you think, oh God, you know, Christ, I've just done that again.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So I think, you know, we can role model not being all or nothing about it.
Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
What would you say to people who maybe would be listening to this and kind of don't know where to start, whether they are the actual person or it's someone who has a person?
Well, so on the one hand, I think practical things you can do is like if you go to the Bodywise website, there's really helpful, very simple information there around understanding an eating disorder as a coping mechanism, around how to approach someone, how to have a conversation and that. So there's practically, I would say, go to the website, read what's there, maybe look at the HSE eating disorder app. There's really helpful things on there and that. That's practically. So intellectually, preparing yourself to have that conversation. If you want to talk to somebody that you're worried about, I would say if there's one thing you can do, try to take on board the idea that the eating disorder is a coping mechanism, that it is a functional illness. So it has a function for the person, makes them feel better. One. Two, remember that everybody has coping mechanisms. We all do things that help us feel that we can get through the day. The majority of us have a coping mechanism that is not so good for us.
Yeah.
And that we probably wouldn't like to advertise. Yeah?
Yes.
Yeah. And all the parents laugh when I say that to them in the group. But like, honestly, that I think everybody has something. Imagine that the person closest to you came to you and said, you know that really private thing that you don't want anyone to know that you do?
Let's talk about it.
Well, not let's talk about it, but you can't do it. You've got to stop. It's bad for you.
Immediately.
Our normal reaction to somebody telling us what we should do, mm-hmm. okay, is to say, you don't know what you're talking about. Leave me alone. I'll do whatever I like. That's our, mm-hmm. Our normal reaction is to get a bit defensive because mm-hmm. we're protective of ourselves. Okay?
Yep.
So think about that. Expect the person to resist the idea that something that they're doing is wrong, because it is very difficult to acknowledge that you are making a mistake, or that, you know, something you're doing isn't okay, or that you're not looking after yourself. That's very difficult to acknowledge. Yep. I hate the word admit. I think it has very negative connotations.
Yeah, it's like you've done something wrong and you're admitting it.
It's like you're
yeah.
guilty of something.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I'd say acknowledge. And when you have that conversation, so expect the person to be resistant. Expect them maybe to get a bit defensive, and don't be put off by it. Think of the conversation as a way of you just expressing that you're concerned for them. Mm. You're not looking for them to confirm you're right. You're not looking for them to agree with you, because they might not be able to. And that's the nature of eating disorders, is that they're counterintuitive. In your first approach, all you want to do is say, I'm really worried about you because, and you maybe say why in a very concrete way. You don't need the person to confirm it for you because you've got alarm bells ringing in your head. But don't focus on what they're doing, focus on how they're feeling. Mm. So you name it. You say, I'm really worried about you because you've lost loads of weight and you're not eating and you never seem to be around for dinner and you're always flying here and there and you don't seem well. But I'm really not worried about you because you seem really stressed. You seem really unhappy and I just feel really worried about you. Yeah, so not focus on what they're doing, but how they're feeling. Mm. And open the door. And it's usually better to think of it as a series of conversations. So you have the first conversation where you just express the concern and you open the door. You go back and few days later and you say, did you think about what I said? I was thinking, is there anything I could do to support you right now or to help? You know, what about going to the GP? Would you like me to go with you? Will I make an appointment?
Yeah.
Ask the person. So the person needs to feel that they have agency in decision making. And sometimes they won't know what to do. But the most important thing is that you ask them first and you have already thought it through. Ideas for what might happen.
Sure.
So I think understanding it's a coping mechanism, understanding that people with eating disorders find forms of help coercive, you know, they feel controlled when you try to help them, will go a long way to you having an approach that's helpful.
Yeah that's really, really helpful advice. And obviously each person is going to react differently.
Yes.
Each person's disorder is different.
Yes.
You're not going to get, you know, the same reaction from each person.
Yeah. And never assume you know about the person's eating disorder.
Yeah.
You know, part of the reason why people have an eating disorder is because it makes them feel special.
Yes.
And different to the rest of the human race. So
yeah.
If they think you're just assuming that their
like
eating
everybody
disorder
else.
Is like everyone else, they're going to
That's going to
really,
be even worse.
Yeah,
yeah,
totally.
Yeah.
They want to know that their eating disorder is individual and special. So with parents and family, I would always say, like, say if somebody says, oh, I'm afraid of getting fat. I would always say, never assume you understand what fat means. Always ask them, well, what does fat mean to you? Because my understanding of fat is completely different to your understanding of fat. And if I ask you what it is, you will feel like I'm curious, like I'm not assuming I understand.
Yeah.
You will feel like I want to get to know what's going on in your head, and it will start this connection, this communication.
Yeah.
And I will start to learn about your particular eating disorder. And when you're supporting someone, it's not really about becoming an expert at eating disorders. It's about becoming an expert at your person's eating disorder.
Yeah.
And that's a big part of the body-wise support, is that we have ideas and knowledge about eating disorders, but what we say to people is, we will give them to you, but you have to go and take them away and apply them to your own situation.
Yeah.
And if they fit, great. And if they don't, leave
yeah,
it.
Yeah, keep what works yeah. and leave the rest. Yeah. yeah. It all kind of seems to just come back to talking and communication, doesn't it?
Yeah, it really does, isn't it?
Well, thank you so much for coming in. If people want to, mm-hmm. it's just bodywise.ie?
Yeah, BODYWHYS.
Perfect. I think that is, yeah, it is such a helpful resource, and the website is really easy to navigate, and as you say, it's really just clearly and simply laid out, which is great. So thank you so much for coming
thank
in.
Thank you for
really,
having
really
me.
Appreciate it.
Thank you.
If you need medical advice, please speak to a professional. You can contact Bodywise, the national charity for eating disorders in Ireland, on 01 210 7906. Or you can get in touch with the Marino Therapy Centre, specialists in eating disorder recovery, through their website on www.marinotherapycentre.com.